This morning, we're going to talk a little bit about faith. I read a story of a man who felt like his personal life and business life was going to the dogs. And he went to his preacher and he told him that same story, that his business was failing, his children were rebelling, and his wife was threatening divorce. And he just didn't know what to do. And the minister told him, "You need to have faith in God." And he said, "I don't know how to have faith in God." And the minister said, "Well, what I want you to do is I want you to pack a beach chair, and I want you to pack your Bible, and I want you to drive down to the nearest beach, and I want you to sit there on that beach at the edge of the water, put the Bible in the chair, and let the wind rife through the pages. And when it stops, I want you to read the first thing you see. And I think that will help you immensely." So about a year goes by, and the minister doesn't see the man until then. And he shows up at church, and he's wearing a three-piece suit. His wife is beaming. His children are smiling. And the minister says, What happened? What did you read?" He said, "Ah, the first thing I read was chapter 11. Well, we're not going to be talking about that kind of faith this morning. Different kind of faith. I'm glad you all came along there at the end. This morning, Dennis led that last hymn, and it's always impressed me about how many great hymns have been based on various scriptures. As I read 1 John 5:4, where it says, "This is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith," you recognize faith is the victory. And again, we read that this morning, and that is a great promise, that this victory has overcome the world, our faith. God there is telling us that our faith is a mighty thing. It gives us power when we otherwise wouldn't have any. In Hebrews chapter 11, there that great chapter of faith in Scripture reinforces that. It tells us that as well. There the author of Hebrew tells us about the faith of men like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, Moses and several others. And then the writer goes on to say there in verse 32, "What more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Japheth, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, and were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection." Now, today, do you all believe that? Do you believe there what the writer of Hebrews says? Because that's the kind of power that I want to have in my life. I want the kind of power, a powerful faith that can overcome this world and give me victory. But there is a fly in that ointment, because the writer of Hebrews doesn't stop there with the words we just read. He goes on to say, "Some were tortured, refusing to accept release so that they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mocking and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were killed with the sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering about in deserts and mountains and in dens and caves of the earth." I don't remember being taught that part in Sunday school. I'm not saying that I wasn't, but can you imagine if that's how we focused all that? We would be okay, children, we're going to learn about how trusting God may get you sawn in two, may get you thrown in jail. It will make you hated by your friends, and you'll be forced to drive a terrible car the rest of your life. That might thin the herd. And I don't know that I wouldn't blame the herd for thinning out. I don't know many people that are interested in a faith that's going to lead to pain, struggling, and torment. Most people want a power in faith that gives them confidence, not fear. And that's why certain kinds of preachers only dwell on something called the prosperity gospel. They teach their followers that all they need to do is believe. Believe and have enough faith, and if you do that, everything is going to be okay, that is going to fix everything. And it's a popular message. It draws crowds, and it's often preached on TV because it is a crowd pleaser. People come, people put their cash in the mail, and they buy these ministers books and tapes. These kind of preachers, they go about selling a God that is channeled through visualization, by positive thinking, and the real popular one, name it and claim it. Now, name it and claim it is all about naming what you want, claiming it before the throne of God, and then being so intense with your faith that you are going to receive what you've named and claimed, that it will be yours. And preachers like this draw people by the thousands because there's a real sense of people out there that feel helpless in this world. And they want a God who is going to step in and fix what is wrong. A God that will give them healing and security and success. Now the thing is, I believe in that God. I believe in that God that the book of Hebrews describes. A God that can enable us to conquer kingdoms. A God who can stop the mouth of lions, who can quench the power of fire, who can make me strong when I am weak. I believe in that God. But I don't believe in these false teachings of charlatans who sell a fake faith that teaches people that all they need to do is pull a few levers and punch a few buttons, and God is going to dance to their tune and do what they want done. Those people teach their followers that all they need to do is follow their teachings, and they can get God to bend to their will, not the other way around. And then when it doesn't work, well, then it's your fault. It's not God's fault. If you had only learned how to visualize success like they taught you to, if you'd only learned how to use the power of positive thinking the way that they told you to, if you had only properly named in true faith, and then claimed what you wanted in true faith, if only you had had enough faith. If you didn't get what you want, if you didn't get what you prayed for, it's your fault. You didn't have enough faith. There was once on a radio call-in program there on a Christian station, the host there had a soft and gentle grandfatherly voice. And he was very reassuring and comforting. And one of his callers that night was a woman who said that she had been attending one of those kind of churches. And she had explained that she was blind. And some of the people she went to church with told her that if she had enough faith, that God would heal her of her blindness. She was confused and she was hurt by their comments. Was the problem really that she didn't have enough faith? Well, the radio host smoothly comforted her and asked her if she had one of those guiding sticks that the blind use to find their way around. And she said she did. And she said, well, the next time someone says to you, if you had enough faith that God would heal you of your blindness, you take that stick and you wrap them upside the head. And you tell them if they would have had enough faith, that wouldn't have hurt so bad. Well, the whole mindset behind those kinds of preachers and those kinds of churches is that faith is the tool that gets you what you want. And if the tool doesn't work, it's your fault. You obviously didn't have enough faith. Because if you had enough faith, you could be healed. You could be successful. You could get the job that you want. You would never suffer. You would never feel pain. Everything in this world would be right. For these false teachers, faith fixes everything. True faith never lets you down. It makes it so we never suffer, we never fail. Well, if that's true, did Paul not have enough faith? He was beaten and he was stoned and he was ran out of almost every town that he went to. Did the apostles not have enough faith because everyone minus John died a martyr's death? Did Christ not have enough faith because he ended up on a cross and died a terrible death? Just before Jesus was betrayed, he spent a long time in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he was praying about his impending crucifixion and death. And do you remember what Jesus prayed? Jesus prayed, "Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done." You see, godly faith is different than what those other preachers are talking about. Those preachers teach that true faith is when you hand God a sheet of paper with your list of everything that you want done. And then if you believe it, you actually expect it to come true, that God will do what you want. But that isn't biblical faith. Biblical faith is when you hand God a blank sheet of paper, and then you tell God, "Not my will, but yours be done. Here's a blank sheet of paper. I trust you to fill in with the things that you want done in my life." Now, I'm not saying that I'm not going to make my request known to God. I'm still going to ask and say things that I prefer done to be done in my life. But I won't feel like I can corner God into a promise that he never made. Jesus never taught the name it and claim it kind of foolishness. Jesus told his followers in John 16:33 that in this world you will have trouble. But take heart, I have overcome the world. Jesus never taught us that a life of faith would be filled with sweetness and light. Jesus never taught us that a life of faith would be painless and comforting. He said, "In this world, you will have trouble." What part of that phrase is being confused? What part don't they understand? If you don't understand that one basic truth, you're going to become a very disappointed Christian. In fact, misunderstanding that truth can lead to a warping of your attitude toward God, to the point where you end up building a wall between yourself and him. A wall that ultimately will intimidate you to the point that you eventually just walk away from God. A few years ago, I read a story of a man on Facebook, and this man was a Christian, but he was always a little bit argumentative about things. And one of the things that he wanted to argue with people about was the promises of God. And he spent a lot of time focusing on the promises about God's faithfulness in the book of Psalms. And he seemed to be a bit offended that it promised that the Psalms painted God as being willing to protect us from our enemies. He didn't accept that because he had experienced too much pain and suffering in his life. And there was the impression that his wife had divorced him, and then that some of the churches he had been in had been difficult for him. Life had been harsh and uncomfortable, and he was angry. But he was too religious of a person to turn his back on God. But you could see that he was angry with God. God hadn't answered his prayers when he thought God should have. And he didn't think that God cared whether he believed it or not. His faith saw no victory because his faith didn't stop the world from beating him up. But his problem was that he wanted God to do things on his terms and on his timetable. But it doesn't work that way. If you look at the stories all throughout the Bible, you find God's people sometimes had to wait years to see how God was working in their lives. I found one graphic on the internet that said it this way, that Joseph waited 15 years, Abraham waited 25 years, Moses waited 40 years, and Jesus waited 30. If God is making you wait, then you are in very good company. My point is that our faith is the victory that overcomes the world. Our God does mighty things in response to our faith. Our God is faithful. He doesn't do things on our terms or on our timetable or in our way. That's just not how it works. But I will tell you that it does work. One of the best stories that we can find about how our faith ought to be is found in the Old Testament. And it's the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In Daniel, the third chapter, in verse 1, we're told there that King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 90 feet high and 9 feet wide. and he set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Everyone was commanded to bow down to this image, but Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they refused to do that. And then they were hauled before the king, who said that they would have one more chance to bow down to his idol, or they were going to be thrown into the fiery furnace and die. But their response was classic. There they said, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. He will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image you have set up." In other words, they're saying God can rescue us. But if not, even if he doesn't rescue us, we're still not going to bow down. And of course, we know the rest of the story. The king was furious, and he commanded that the fire be made seven times hotter than he had for these three young men to be thrown into the flames. And God rescued them from those flames. But if not, they were saying that their faith was the victory that overcame the world. The king could kill them, but he could not kill their faith. Their God was big enough to rescue them. But if not, they still believed that they would not, they still believed in a way that they would not disobey him in this matter. They had no intention of trying to manipulate God to do things their way. Centuries later, some other believers were facing certain death. And they stood against an enemy in France. But the enemy, the Nazi army, steadily was pushing them back. The Blitzkrieg and the Panzers and the Luftwaffe and the skill of the Nazi forces were becoming too much for them. And eventually they found themselves defending a strip of beach on the shores of Dunkirk. There was no way they could escape. It was a matter of time before Hitler's forces finally crushed them. And they managed to finally send a message back to England. And it consisted of three words. And it said, "But if not." In England, everyone knew what these men were saying. Our God is able to deliver us. But if not, we will not surrender. We will die against this foe. We will not give up. There are people today that study military history that still puzzle over the reason why Hitler did not crush the forces of France and Britain while he had them cornered there on the beaches of Dunkirk. It makes really no sense at all. What possible reason could there be for holding back? Well, I think if we allow ourselves, I think we know why. I think we know why Hitler stayed his hand. In truth, these men had surrendered themselves into the power of God. They were willing to do their duty and to die, even if their God was not able to rescue them. But God did rescue them in one of the most dynamic rescues of World War II. Over the next 9 days, England mobilized every ship, every yacht, every dinghy that they could find, and they went on to rescue 336,000 men from certain death. Now, why were these men rescued? Well, I could argue it was because their faith was the victory that overcame the world. And that's what God calls us to do as well. To have a faith to stand firm, even in the face of certain loss and death. A faith that overcomes the world. But you can't have that faith if you don't belong to Jesus Christ. And this morning, we offer the invitation to anyone that doesn't belong to Christ to come forward and to join that body of the blessed. That this morning, if that pertains to you, we invite you to come as together we stand and we sing.